Okay, welcome everyone. Sorry for the snag there and getting this open on time. I typed in the wrong password, but I think now I got the right password for this class. Since I just opened it up, I'll wait a few minutes here because there's only a few of us in here right now. Just give people a few more minutes to trickle in and then we'll get going. Okay, welcome. This is the office hours session for week one of Principles of Economics, the Mises Academy. And we've only got a few people logged in, so I'll go ahead and just turn it over to you. Daniel, do you have anything you want me to talk about? Because you can just go ahead and type it in the chat box since there's so few of us right now. Okay, sure. I'll go look those up. So Daniel had posted some questions in the forum, so I'll go look those up. I'm having trouble. Where is it? Did you post it under the name Daniel? And the questions for Professor Week One? Okay. Because I'm scrolling through and I'm not seeing anything by anyone named Daniel. You know what? I think I'm looking at the first section of the principles class. That's what's going on. Okay, I got it, Daniel. What happened is I was looking at the principles section that was in the fall. Okay, so Daniel says, if an economic theory makes certain predictions about the real world, can't empirical data prove or disprove it? And how can one accuse Keynesians of causing havoc in the economy otherwise? Okay, so that's a good question. Well, the problem is economics doesn't actually make predictions about the absolute effect of something. It just talks about the tendency or what direction something's going to move in. So let me just give you, rather than speaking in generic terms, let me just give you a specific example. So one thing we could say is that I certainly subscribe to the proposition, or the law, if you will, that other things equal, if there's an increase in the quantity of money, then prices will be higher, or prices will go up. Okay, but the important thing is that phrase, other things equal. And so if in reality next year the quantity of money goes way up and prices go down, that doesn't disprove my theory, because other things might not be equal. Or to give you a different example, you could say other things equal, if the demand for apples goes up, then the price of apples will go up. And that's a very well-established principle in economics, right? If the demand goes up, the price goes up. But what if I'm looking and I see that next year let me do supply, because supply might be easier for you. Say other things equal, if the supply of apples goes up, or other things equal, if the supply of oil goes up, then the price should go down. Right, because there's more oil going around, so the price per unit should go down. And then we're looking at the data, and we see that the quantity supplied of oil went up from December to July, and yet the price went up also. And you could do that the other way around. You could say, other things equal, if the price of something goes up, we expect consumers will buy less of it. That's the law of demand, right? So I'll say that again. This is probably the easiest example, the one that I've given you. So you say, okay, as economists, we believe in the law of demand. It says if the price of something goes up, consumers will want to buy fewer units of it, other things equal. Okay, and then so you say, well, let's go test that law. And you look and you see gasoline prices were $3, let's say, in December, and consumers bought this many gallons. But then by July, gasoline prices had risen to $3.80, and consumers bought more gasoline in July than they did in December. Oh my gosh, it's a falsification of the law of demand. And you say, well no, it's not, because what happened is, you'd say the demand curve shifted. Other things aren't equal, that people want to do more driving in July than they do in December. And so even though the price was higher in July for gasoline, motorists actually bought more gallons of gasoline. Okay, so there, that sort of illustrates both aspects of this, that empirically, you can't refute the law of demand. There's no data you could look at that would make you conclude, oh my gosh, this law is wrong. But even having said that, I still think it's very useful to think in terms of the law of demand. In other words, you might think, well, then what good is it if it can never be proven wrong? Then how do you know it's right? And the answer to that is, well, you know it's right because it's a conceptual thing, and you reason logically from the definition of it, and it's just a framework. So using supply and demand analysis, which we'll do more concretely later on in this course, but using that framework is just a way of organizing your thinking. It's a way of looking at the world. So yeah, it can't be right or wrong. That's not really even a meaningful question. It's just a way of organizing the data that's out there, the price data and the quantity data. It's a way of organizing it into a systematic framework, so you're not arguing in a circle when you're trying to explain price changes. And but then that begs the question, or raises the question rather, well then what? How do you know? Why would you use it? What's it good for? And you say, well, maybe it isn't good. Okay, but the fact that it can't be falsified doesn't rule it out as a useful thing. So now we're being a little bit coy. I mean, if you thought, how can I put it? It's hard to explain. Yeah, that is true. That's what I'm trying to get across to you is, so we're not using it because we're sure, oh, it can't be falsified, so therefore it must be good. I mean, that's not the justification for using it, is simply that it can never be proven wrong. Because like you said, you could say that about lots of stuff. All right? So that's partly why I did the geometry example, is that that is an a priori demonstration, right? We don't need to go and look at triangles to test the Pythagorean theorem. And so it would never be falsified. So the reason we continue to teach people the Pythagorean theorem is not that it's passed empirical tests, but it's not, the reason we teach it is also not merely that we're guaranteed that it's true, because there's lots of theorems you could prove in geometry that are stupid, right? That aren't useful for anything. They're not interesting. Whereas the Pythagorean theorem, that's interesting. You feel like you know something more about reality after having learned the Pythagorean theorem. And then, like I said, there's also applications in engineering. So it's the same thing with economics. I certainly personally believe that knowing the framework, the analytical framework of supply and demand analysis, helps me interpret the world. And so why is that? Well, because yeah, you do see times where it does look like other things are sufficiently equal so that the effect your model says pops out. So, why were there gas lines in the 1970s in the United States? It's because that's when Nixon imposed price controls, and then all of a sudden, look at that—you got gas lines. And then when they got rid of the price controls, the gas lines disappeared. Or, you know, why? I'm trying to think of other. Okay, so you see things like that. Or with Hugo Chavez, he imposed price controls, and then you saw shortages developing there. All right, so it's when we do the chapter on rent control, which we're going to do later on in the course, you know, there's lots of things characterizing the housing market or the rental market in a major city like New York where they have rent control at least still in places. And so the things that the theory predicts, you can go see them. So that's what I mean, that the fact that our laws or principles say this is the impact this change would have, and so if everything else stayed the same, you would clearly see this. But in the real world, sometimes that effect can get swamped by other things. What I'm saying is, in practice, enough of the time it doesn't get swamped by the other things that I feel like it's still useful to walk around deploying that principle when I'm looking at a situation, even though I know it sometimes it can get swamped. And that's partly where economists can disagree with each other, is someone might say, well, that's not a useful principle. So for example, I said a few minutes ago, I think it's a very useful thing to know that other things equal, if the Federal Reserve pumps in more money, you're going to see prices rise. And so that's unobjectionable. I mean, nobody could argue with what I just said. But what they might argue is that in funky situations, that law or that principle gets swamped by other things. So for example, over the last few years, it's not as obvious. You know, with the amount of money that the Fed has created, and it depends how you, what definition of money you're using, but I thought prices would be higher now than they are. Okay, so somebody could, so a Keynesian might say, like Paul Krugman would say, you guys are totally wrong. You were worried about price inflation for the last 2 years because you just do the simplistic framework where you assume everything else stays constant and then the Fed injects more money, and so you think prices are going to go up. But actually, other things aren't equal. We're in this recession. There's a liquidity trap, blah, blah, blah. And so that's why I predicted prices wouldn't go up. And so far, I've been right. And that's what Paul Krugman says on his blog regularly. So that's the kind of thing where it's not that events have disproved my theory. It's just possibly that we're looking at the wrong measurements because, you know, certain prices have gone way up. And so maybe, you know, we're wrong just to focus on the CPI or something like that. Because what's happened is the demand to hold money has gone up too because of the financial panic. And so really what I'm saying is if the Fed hadn't done all the stuff it had done, prices would be a lot lower now than they are in fact. So it's still true that my principle kicked in. Prices are higher now than they otherwise would have been. It's just that since prices would have collapsed, now they're just rising slightly. Okay, so that's... that's the way I explain it. But if that happened a lot, if it were always the case that when the Fed printed more money, it was only to offset this thing that was going to cause prices to collapse, well, then maybe it wouldn't be that useful to walk around thinking, uh-oh, printing money is going to lead to price rises if it barely ever did in practice. Okay, so it's sort of a judgment call as to whether your a priori principle or framework is useful and is giving you like a good hunch. So I don't mean to be coy. I mean, you use those things to make empirical predictions in your own life for guidance. Just like with the Pythagorean theorem, even though we know we're never in practice going to find a triangle that can violate it, because if we do, then it must not actually be a right triangle, or or you're measuring it wrong or something. Even so, if it's possible that we could live in a world, like, I don't know how much you know about physics, but I think modern physicists would say technically we don't live in a Euclidean universe, that the universe is, you know, space itself is curved. It's just that, at least on our planet, and for, you know, the amount of gravity that Earth has and how fast we're going and stuff like that, it's okay as a first approximation to imagine that the world is Euclidean, and that's why Euclidean geometry is useful for engineers and things. But if we lived, you know, in a really massive planet or something that had strong gravity, maybe it wouldn't be useful. So even though Euclidean geometry would still be true, maybe those people would discover it and then not use it for anything because it would be pointless. Okay, that's what I'm getting at, that I think it does matter. And, like, you know, and certainly in interwar Germany, they were printing a bunch of marks, and then the value of the mark plummeted, and prices went way up. So certainly, there's a good example of when that idea of printing a bunch of money leads to price hikes shows its power, and that it would have been better if those people had been guided by that rather than ignoring it. So I guess that's the way I would talk about those sorts of things. And so notice you're bringing up Keynesianism. It's the same thing, that what the Keynesians are saying, like, let's take the Obama stimulus package. They don't worry about the a priori foundations and things, but I think if we were to recast what they were saying, they would say, look, other things equal, if the government increases the demand for goods and services, then employment will go up, or unemployment rates will come down, and measured GDP will go up. And so that can be a true, you know, that is true, right? But the way the Austrians and other critics were objecting to that would be to say, but yeah, other things aren't going to be equal, though. People in the private sector, if they know the government is going to commit itself to borrowing $1 trillion more dollars, or whatever the number is going to be, and spending it, well, they know that their taxes are going to go up, and also interest rates are going to be higher than they otherwise would have been if the government's borrowing that much. So there's, you know, because more capital's flowing to the government rather than to private borrowers. And so other things aren't equal, and so it's not clear that you're even going to, on your own terms, boost aggregate demand, because maybe people in the private sector cut their spending down because they know they're going to have to pay higher taxes and interest rates are going to be higher and so forth. And so maybe it's a wash, or maybe it's even worse. Maybe unemployment goes up. And so that's, so that, you know, so there you could notice it's sort of an empirical argument. I mean, you can bring up other causes that kick in that you could say are necessarily followed from the government's doing, but it's almost an empirical issue. And so, and I would argue that this particular episode showed that the, you know, the people claiming that the stimulus package would help things, well, we saw, no, it didn't, even according to what you thought was going to happen. So it's, but again, it, I don't think it's actually correct to say, we just disprove your theory, because their theory technically could be cast as saying other things equal. And so it didn't disprove it. But again, so you're asking, well, and how do you ever settle on a framework? Well, I think it's a judgment call that you got to say, in general, if you're walking around with the Keynesian worldview, does that help you or not? Does that, and so there's things like that as well. Also, I mean, you can try to do internal critiques. So I don't mean to suggest it's just a matter of using your judgment and empirically. I mean, there, I think the Keynesian model leaves, is very crude and leaves out a lot of the intricacies of capital theory. And so on that score, you can just say, well, look, at your theory is overlooking a lot of stuff. My theory is richer. And so even on a priori grounds, you know, you're overlooking all these mechanisms that would counteract the sort of thing you're trying to model. All right, so, I mean, there's ways. Like, if somebody just had a theory saying, you know, other things equal, if I go around saying, come on, go team, let's go produce, guys, that will help the economy. I mean, it might be hard to disprove or prove that, but I think a lot of people would say that's such a crude, simplistic theory that takes into account nothing about how a modern economy works that I'm not even going to deal with it. That's silly. Okay, so I don't mean to suggest that it's, that, you know, you can't touch another theory as long as it's cast on a priori grounds. Daniel says, but that's where your values come in to judge the different frameworks, right? A non-economic part. I'm not sure what you mean by values. That, I mean, you want, the theory needs to be internally consistent. All right, so somebody could be saying something, casting it as other things equal, but if they've got one assumption that contradicts something else, I mean, there you can just say, no, your theory is internally contradictory. So you're asking to judge the usefulness of the framework. It's, yeah, I mean, I don't know what you mean when you say values. It's, I guess part of it is the sort of thing you want the economics to do. And so if you're a Keynesian and you're just, your big thing is you want, you're worried about getting unemployment down, then you're going to be focusing on things like that. Whereas if you're an Austrian, you tend to care more about making sure resources get allocated properly and making sure entrepreneurs have the right signals to match the capital structure with what consumers' preferences are for having consumption sooner rather than later. So it's, that stuff is all, you're right, that stuff's all involved. I mean, to try to explain to you why it is in practice that Keynesians and Austrians don't agree on anything, because you'd think, come on, over the decades, can't you guys be scientific and figure out who's right or not? And it's really messy because of the differences between the social and the natural sciences, and this issue of both Austrians and Keynesians, their principles or their laws or their models do not make unambiguous point predictions about unemployment's going to be 6.8% next quarter. And if it's not, my theory's wrong. They don't talk like that. So that's, whereas astronomy, I mean, astronomers don't say, we have this model of the solar system and we think there's going to be a tendency for Jupiter to revolve faster next year than it did last year, but even if it doesn't, it's just because it was offset because there was a comet or so. You know what I'm saying? That's not the way astronomers talk. They say, no, this is our model, and if this model is correct, Jupiter's going to be right here. If we point the telescope at this time of the night at the sky, we better see Jupiter, and if we don't, our model's wrong. Okay, that's the way astronomers talk, and you know they could justifiably think economists are a bunch of children who don't even understand science the way we talk. So anyway, that's part of it. Okay, Jeff has joined us. Jeff says, what do you think of Hoppe's take on Mises' action axiom? As I understand it, he claims the action axiom can't be denied because the denial itself is an action. I just want to clarify for people who are taking this course, and if you're listening to the recording of this Office Hours, this stuff that these guys are asking me is all real abstract philosophical stuff, so I'm answering the questions because they're the ones who showed up, and that's what this is for, but I know there are some like seventh graders who are taking this class and are a little bit intimidated. You don't need to know all this stuff for the class. I mean, just if you listen to my lectures and read the textbook, that's what you need to know for the quizzes and for the midterm and the final. So if you don't know what we're talking about here, don't be scared. But again, these are the people who showed up at the office hours, and this is what they're asking me. So that's why I'm catering to these questions. But this stuff is pretty high level for what you need to know for this course. Okay, so Jeff, for your question, yeah, let me just talk a little bit about that. So Mises' action axiom says quite simply that people act, and to elaborate on that, he means people have subjective preferences and they use their reason to try to achieve those objectives, to use means to achieve ends. And there's a little bit of history there. And so what Mises does is he says, okay, if you give me the action axiom, if you accept that, then I can logically deduce all sorts of implications from that. And we'll in this course, we will get into that stuff about what sort of things can you... what economic principles or concepts sort of flow out of your acknowledgement that there are other human minds out there that are trying to achieve ends and that they use their reason to do that. Okay, so it's surprising how much stuff flows out of that acknowledgement on your part, stuff that we would normally consider to be economic. And so that is in the textbook, and we will dive into that stuff. But to now talk about things that aren't in the textbook and you don't need to know for the class... So, as you guys know, Mises famously said that sort of deduction that's a priori, that you're not empirically testing that stuff. That's just, you know, that if people act, then you can start deducing these things, and those conclusions you can know a priori. You don't have to go test them. But what's interesting is, what is the status of the action axiom itself? How do you know the action axiom is true? Is that a priori, or is that an empirical matter? In other words, you know, how do you know that other people act? Is that, you know, because that doesn't seem like something you would know just from introspection. And so Israel Kirzner, who was at NYU for a long time and directly studied under Mises, I asked him that question one time. And he said, I hope I'm not misremembering what he told me, but I'm almost positive he told me that once he asked Mises and said, how do we know that people act? And Mises said, through observation. All right, so that's kind of an interesting thing, because, you know, people would think, oh, no, Mises built his whole edifice on a priori stuff, and yet the foundation of it, the action axiom... When you say, well, how do you know that thing is true? Mises apparently verbally told Israel Kirzner, you know that through observation, which is like an empirical thing. And then Murray Rothbard, too, I'm trying to remember where he wrote this. I'm not sure. Maybe Man, Economy, and State, but it could have been some other essay. He actually, I think it was the other essay. He said, I don't remember his exact words, but he also said that the way we know the action axiom, it's broadly empirical. And not in the sense that we do something in a lab, but just, you know, why is it that you believe you're not the only mind, right? Why is it that you think there are other minds out there, other consciousnesses, or other egos, whatever term you want to use? And Rothbard said, well, it's not really that you deduce that just in your own mind. I mean, you kind of, just looking at the world, get that sense, right? That seems like that has to be true. Like, that's the most plausible theory, the most plausible explanation for all the stuff that you observe on a daily basis is that there are other people with their own minds and their own subjective preferences, that you're not, it's not that the stuff that you experience firsthand in terms of your thought and your desires to do things, I mean, it's possible you're the only person in the universe. You know, that's called solipsism. That's a philosophical perspective to say, what if I am the only mind in all these other things that walk around and look like people, and they act as if they have feelings and they're thinking and they're doing stuff like that, but really they're not? What if they're all just a bunch of mindless robots? Or, you know, even if they're biological, but they're not actually thinking like I am. Because you technically don't know that. You can't literally get inside someone else's mind and experience their experiences. It's just you're seeing their behavior and you're inferring that, you know, that's the kind of behavior my body makes when I'm having these internal experiences. So I'm going to hypothesize that there's a mind sort of like mine controlling that thing over there, that those bodily movements, right? So it gets kind of philosophical, but the point was that Rothbard and Mises both apparently believed that in itself is not an a priori thing. That's a theory you're using. That seems to have a lot of empirical support behind it. It's a very plausible theory, but nonetheless, it's an empirical thing. And so what Hoppe tried to do is he said that he didn't like that. He said, no, we should have a firmer foundation for the action axiom. And so he said, well, how do I establish that? He said, well, let me back up a step. I'm trying to think of a good example. Well, there's in philosophy, there's this thing called a performative contradiction. All right, so and it's to be distinguished from just a regular contradiction. So it's, I think I'm borrowing this example from David Gordon. If it's not a contradiction for one of you guys to say Robert Murphy is dead, because I could be dead, right? That's not a contradiction. At some point, I will be dead, and it will be true when someone says Robert Murphy is dead. But what would be a performative contradiction is if, as opposed to if no one can ever say A is not A, that is a contradiction flat out, right? So no speaker can ever utter that statement without it being a contradiction. Whereas the statement Robert Murphy is dead, there's nothing contradictory about that statement per se. And it's like I say, at some point it'll even be true and someone can say it at that point. But what would be a performative contradiction is if I say that. If I say Robert Murphy is dead and the Robert Murphy refers to me, well, that's a performative contradiction because the fact that I'm saying that proves I'm not dead. Okay? So, or if I say I never talk, well, that's a performative contradiction. I contradicted myself in the act of asserting that. Right? Whereas, so the fact that the statement that Robert Murphy never talks, that's not a contradiction. It's possible that I don't ever talk. And somebody else might say that about me. But if I say to you, hey, you know what? I never, ever talk, ever. Then you're going to say, well, you just did. You just contradicted yourself. Okay, so you see how there's, so that's the philosophical concept that Hoppe is using. It's not a statement that's a contradiction per se. It's a statement that becomes a contradiction as you utter it. Okay? And so he's saying with the action axiom that it's logically possible to imagine that people don't act. Right? That it's not contradictory to think that people don't... Well, I gotta be careful. It's not contradictory... The statement of the actual, the free-floating concept, if you will, there is no action in the Misesian sense, that's not internally contradictory. That's not like the free-floating statement, A is not A. I mean, that's just a flat-out contradiction, no matter what. But the free-floating statement, people do not act in the way that Ludwig von Mises thought they did, that isn't a contradiction. You could even imagine it to be true. But what Hoppe's point is, there's no way a human being can sort of express that without contradicting it. That I can't say people don't act because I just did act. Right? And or I can't even really think it because thinking is an action. And so that's what Hoppe is getting at, is that there's no way for you as a rational being to try to put forward the claim that Mises was wrong when he said people act, because the very act of you doing it, that is what Mises has in mind. Okay, that is an action in the Misesian sense. So anybody who disputes what Mises is saying is actually proving that he's right. Okay, so that's what Hoppe is doing there. And Mises, what's funny is that was implicit. I mean, Hoppe didn't invent that from scratch. I mean, Mises himself in there, I'm almost positive in Human Action itself, has passages where he says something like somebody who tries not to act, right? Like by staying perfectly still and not moving their arms around and like holding their breath, thinking, you know, and trying to disprove the action axiom, he said, no, that's still an action. It's just they would be, taking steps to try to achieve an end, namely the violation of the action axiom, but they would be unsuccessful. So he said, yep, that would be an action, but it would be an unsuccessful one. Just like if you're trying to make it rain and you're dancing around, you know, waving incense instead of trying to appease the rain gods, Mises would say, that is still a rational action in my terminology. You're using your reason to achieve your objectives. It's just you would be unsuccessful. You would have chosen an unsuitable means that you falsely believed appeasing the rain gods is going to make water fall out of the sky. But what you're doing is still an action. And so Mises says, by the same token, if you're going to try to set out to disprove the action axiom by remaining perfectly still or something like that, thinking, oh, I'm not acting, so therefore Mises is wrong. Mises goes, no, you are acting in my sense. You're using your control over your body and whatever to try to achieve an end of refuting me, but you chose poorly. You didn't actually achieve your objective, but that's still action because there's nothing that says action has to be successful. So that stuff's in Mises and Hoppe, I think, what his contribution was to link that with this philosophical tradition, this notion of a performative contradiction. So anyway, again, for those of you who are tuning in to this, or Carl, you just came in a bit late, don't worry. This is a really pretty high-level philosophical stuff, but I'm just answering the questions that are being asked. Okay, so Carl, do you have any specific question? Because right now there's only a few of you logged in here, and I've answered the other people so far. So if you have a question, I can address that. We've got about 20 minutes left. If not, Daniel or Jeff, if you have other questions, go ahead and post them, because it's just you guys right now. Okay. Okay, so Daniel says, still, if the action axiom is derived from observation of humans acting purposefully, can't specific sciences about human thought and behavior, example psychology, ever discover something about how humans choose their purposes that could change the action axiom and thus all of economics? Okay, well, I think the answer is no, but let me just explain why. So, at least it, coming from the viewpoint of Ludwig von Mises, so he is going to say this: the sorts of things he derives from the action axiom are very general. They're things. So, in other words, what can we say? Just knowing that people have subjective preferences and they use their reason to try to achieve, to satisfy them, and they use means to achieve ends. Okay, those are all packaged into the action axiom. So Mises says, you know, what sort of things can we conclude from that, just from that mere fact? If you know, let's put aside for the moment, how do we know that that fact is true? Assume it is true. What can we conclude from that? So we're not going to conclude things like, oh, people will tend to use their scarce resources to provide for their life, you know, the continuation of their life first, and only then will they use resources to cater to their higher abstract needs, like their spiritual needs or something like that, but they're going to take care of their food first. No, I mean, that stuff, you're getting too specific. You can't conclude those sorts of things from praxeology, or from what Mises' term is for the study of action itself. Okay, so you can't... So what you're saying, Daniel, is you're right. Psychology, or there's work, you know, in behavioral economics is a certain field now that's in vogue, and people are looking at things like... you know, there's certain things that you find empirically that, for example, if you say to somebody, if I show somebody, I don't know, an iPod, somebody, let's say somebody who doesn't have an iPod, I show them an iPod and I say, how much do you want to pay me for this thing? They'll say a certain number, you know, or if I say, how much would you be willing to pay for this? You'll say a certain number. Now, if I give it to them, and then I say, I'm going to take that away from you unless you pay me a certain amount. How much are you going to be willing to pay me to keep it? Typically, I think I have this right, the second number is going to be higher. So in other words, once people have something and they view it as theirs, they value it more, and they don't want to give it up. So they're willing to pay more to keep it than they're willing to pay to acquire it in the first place. And so a lot of these I'm not even sure if that's behavioral economics. I get the different fields mixed up, but the people who are doing research along these lines, you know, they're trying to come up with sort of theories of how human minds work, and you know, how your emotions are involved, and how you frame the issue matters, that kind of stuff. And they think that's important. So they think that. So what I just described to you in terms of a standard mainstream neoclassical economic model, that's illogical. That's irrational. You know, why should you be... It shouldn't matter to you whether the thing is in your possession or not. The question is just on the margin, how much more utility will that thing give you? And then what else could you buy with the money, and how much utility would that stuff give you? And then you're a rational utility-maximizing agent. You should be able to say what the number is, right? So the fact that that people would be willing to pay more to keep something that they were given, rather than they'd be willing to pay to acquire something that they hadn't been given, if it's the same thing, you know, that's a little bit weird. And especially if the amounts of money are small, so that it's, you know, there's not an issue of you're wealthier if they give you the thing, you know, because that's a possible issue too. But you see what I'm saying, that so there are a lot of economists doing work like that, that apparently violates, you know, what most professional economists would think of as like the standard model of human behavior. Or to give you a different example, there's a lot of work in the experimental economics on little simple game theory things. And so you have, it's called the ultimatum game. That's the one I'm most familiar with. Right? So you have two people in this game, and there's $100 that they're going to split. And the first person gets to propose the division of the $100 to the second person. So the first person can say, okay, how about I keep 80 and you keep 20? Or the first person can say, I'll keep 50 and you keep 50. Or the first person can say, I'll keep 99 and you keep a dollar. Okay, and then the second person gets to either accept it and then the deal goes through, or he rejects it and they both get zero. And so in standard models of rational human beings, in terms of the way mainstream economists with their mathematical models do it, the only equilibrium is for the first person to say, I keep $100, you keep zero, and the second person to say yes. Okay? Because any other possibility isn't an equilibrium. That if the first person says, how about I keep 99 and you keep $1, well, now that it's the second person's decision, he should say yes, right? Because what is he looking at? He's looking at, do I get a dollar or do I get zero, right? Because if he says yes, he gets the dollar. If he says zero, they both get nothing. Well, people like money, right? So he should take a dollar. Why not take a dollar? But yet, if that's what his rule is, the first person, why would he give the other guy a dollar? Why wouldn't he say, I'll take $99.50 and you only take 50 cents? And then, you know, so in the limit, if you allow for the money amounts to be infinitely divisible, well, they're the only equal. The first person shouldn't settle for anything less than the whole pot, because he could always make himself a little bit better by offering the other guy, you know, half as much. And so the only mathematical stable point in that is for the first guy to say, I'll keep 100, you keep zero, and the other guy is indifferent, right? He says, okay, because either way he's getting zero, so what does he care? Well, obviously, in the real world, in the lab, that's not how it works out. In the real world, if somebody proposes, hey, how about I get 90 and you get 10, a lot of times those people say, heck no, and they reject it to spite the person for making such an unfair offer, right? And so clearly nobody, well, maybe not nobody, but it'd be very rare to see the first person say, how about I keep 100 and you keep zero, and the second guy say, okay. I mean, that just about never happens. The first guy, for one thing, wouldn't dream of making such a ridiculous offer, and then if he did, the second person's not going to accept it, right? But yet again, the way mainstream mathematical game theory works, the way you set that game up, if you allow for the proposer to make infinitely divisible increments in the offering, the only equilibrium is where he says, I want all of it and you get nothing. So in that kind of thing, there's where the people who are doing this work trying to say, oh wait, conventional economics is modeling people all wrong, because we have to take into account, you know, envy and the feelings of fairness and blah, blah, blah. That's good. And I think it's useful that economists are doing that, but that just shows how crazy mainstream economists are, right? And just so you know, I used to think that the game theorists knew fully well that was just a quirk of their modeling, and that just showed the limitations of their mathematical approach. And that as human beings, like if you said, okay guys, forget, you know, we're not doing a test right now in a class on game theory. You know, you're not having to write out the Nash equilibrium. Just I'm asking you as human beings, your personal judgment in practice, what do you think would happen here? And I thought they would give the right answer, that they would know, but that's not what happened. There was a game theory conference and this is my professor at NYU. The reason I know game theory is that was like my major at NYU. So the professor there was telling us this story, and this guy was an up and comer, you know, a very well published guy, a young guy, but very well accomplished in game theory. So he knows what he's talking about, and he's telling us this story that he was at a game theory conference, and the guy at the podium, you know, asks all the game theorists in attendance, you're going to play this game and you're the first person. How much are you going to, what are you going to propose to give to the second person? So write down your answers. And so they all write it down and they collect it and they look at it. And my recollection of what this guy said is every single person put, I get 100%, the other guy gets 0, except one person said 50-50. And then they thought, well, who's this guy? You know, this idiot who put 50-50 down. And they looked at, they figured, you know, and they asked the crowd, you know, who wrote 50-50? We're just curious. And the guy who it was like a Nobel Prize winner. And I'm trying to think, shoot, the name escapes me now. I don't know if he was a Nobel Prize winner at that time, but eventually he was, for work in game theory and stuff. And I can't believe the names escaped me. But anyway, it's a name. It's not a name you guys might know, but other economists would know the name. And they asked it, and this is the guy telling the story, the NYU professor telling us this story, saying, and so we said, you know, master, why would you put 50-50 down? And he said, and his answer was, because you don't know how crazy the other guy is. And he was saying this like, oh, and like everyone was like, oh, like there was some huge insight that if you were in the real world, the pot's $100 and you had to propose to the second guy, how are we going to divide this? That maybe you wouldn't want to say, how about I keep 100 and you keep 0? Even though, well, gee, he should be okay with that because he's going to get 0 either way. That was supposed to be this path-breaking insight, right? So that's really what made me think, holy cow, these guys really are crazy. Okay, because I just assumed we all knew the model said one thing, but reality said something else, but we got to play by the rules of the math model. But no, I mean, these people actually believed that model was what they should go do in the real world. So anyway, that's just a long way of saying that, yeah, there is a lot of work in what's called behavioral economics, and there's overlap between like the psychologists and economics, and there's sort of like interdisciplinary work and that stuff. And that's, I think that stuff is all useful, again, to show the limitations of what mainstream economists think motivates human beings. But I'm just trying to stress that stuff bounces off harmlessly from Austrian economics, at least the way Mises conceives of it. That, you know, there's nothing, you know, Mises doesn't have anything to say about in that game, the ultimatum game where you propose something to somebody else and he can accept or reject it. I mean, Austrian economics per se doesn't say anything about that. It just says, almost vacuously, if you will, well, the first person will make the proposal that gives him the most satisfaction, and the second person will make the decision to accept or reject based on what gives him the most happiness or satisfaction. And, you know, you could, no matter what happens, you can just say, well, that's what the first person got the most satisfaction from, and so on. So what motivates people to have certain preferences, I think that's important for people to know, and even economists to know, because it helps them better apply their abstract theory to the real world and to make sense of what's actually going on. But strictly speaking, the action axiom and all the stuff you deduce from it, it doesn't matter what the content of those preferences are. So whether people are really selfish and money-grubbing and all they care about is a buck, or whether people are ascetic monks and they think that money is dirty. I mean, Austrian economics explains their actions equally well. Now, it's true, a lot of the stuff you develop might not be as useful if it were a world of aesthetic monks, and they, you know, they didn't care about material goods. It's possible, but even there, I'm not so sure. But what is for sure true is that the principles or rules or laws of economics that we have, they apply regardless of what people's preferences are. Okay, we got about 3 minutes, so why don't I do one last question? Jeff says, so as an economist, one shouldn't assume any objective way to determine what's rational. We can only say it's subjectively rational from each individual's point of view. Well, it depends how we're using the word rational. But for sure, Austrians tend to use that word in a different way from how mainstream economists use it. So mainstream economists, a lot of times, I think they use the word rational to mean intelligent. And that's not how Austrians use it. That, like I say, for Mises, he even says in several places that the phrase rational action, I think the word he uses is pleonastic, or is a pleonasm or something like that. And I had to go look up what the heck does that word mean. I never heard it before. What it means, redundant. So he's saying you're not adding more information by throwing on the adjective rational when you're saying human action. So he doesn't. And then also, the phrase irrational action to Mises is contradictory. You can't have irrational action. If he said, usually what people in everyday language mean when they want to say, oh, that guy's acting irrationally, all they really mean is he's acting unusually. You know, most people don't act like that, and so this guy's acting funny. Or they mean, we believe this person is using the inappropriate means to achieve what we think his end is. Okay, that's another way you could say irrational. But Mises has some examples. He said, look, at one point, doctors thought the way to help somebody would be to use leeches and bleed the person. Okay, and actually, by the way, I think actually technically sometimes you still do use that treatment even nowadays. But I think they used it a lot a long time ago, whereas now for most of those cases you wouldn't do that. And so Mises says, is it that the doctors back then were behaving irrationally? Do we want to say that their actions were irrational? And he said, no, it's just they were operating under faulty theories about medicine and what would help the human body, whereas now we have better information. He said, but 200 years from now, surgeons might look back at what we're doing and think that what we're doing is irrational. But again, that would be unfair. It's not that what we're doing is irrational, it's just possibly we're operating on the basis of wrong information. And Mises pushes it pretty far, and he said even, you know, people that, this is why Mises actually liked Freudian psychology, because Mises took Freud's central contribution to be was that Freud was trying to make sense out of what looked to be crazy behavior, what looked to be irrational action. And that he was saying, no, what's motivating these people is that they have objectives that most of us don't have, and that what they're doing in their mind is actually the right way to achieve satisfaction. But to us, it looks like it's crazy, but only because, for one thing, we might, you know, our preferences might be different, and for another thing, you know, our theories as to how do you achieve certain things in the world might be different from that person's. Okay, so to answer your question, Jeff, yeah, I think it's true that in the way Mises uses the term, everybody who's acting is rational. And if you don't like that terminology, well, then okay, but you just have to understand, what does he mean by it? Because the word rational, what does that mean? It's based on reason. So somebody who's using reason to achieve something, that's rational action. And so it's a little bit tricky, because in certain situations you might say somebody is being very unreasonable, but that's more, you know, that's not really getting at the heart of what Mises is talking about there. So the distinction for Mises, when he says action versus mindless behavior, he's not distinguishing between somebody who's being very calm and sober and carefully thinking through something, and someone who's just doing something but seat of the pants. No, he means more somebody who's playing the game of Simon Says and goes like this because the person said Simon Says go like that, as opposed to a gunshot goes off and the person just flinches. Right? So that's the distinction between action and just mere behavior, or mindless action, or mindless behavior, I should say. That so it's that's what action is about, and like I say, that's some people when I get that across to them, they think, oh, well, that's kind of a broad category of things, and why don't, you know, who cares about that? Why don't we focus in on action that's based upon solid thought, or, you know, solid analysis? And Mises says no, because for one thing, that's kind of arbitrary. You know, then we have to start arguing about what's the right analysis in this situation, and also it's going to change. That the stuff we think right now is very smart and rational, and in the layman's language, maybe 50 years from now they're going to think it's crazy. So there's that problem. But he said also, it's surprising how much we can develop just focusing on intentional behavior, whether or not we think the means chosen are suitable to obtain the ends. Okay, well, that's the end of the time we have, and thanks for tuning in, guys. So remember, if you're taking the class for credit, you need to do your quiz by Tuesday, 11:59 p.m. And I'll see you guys on Wednesday.